Chapter 21. Oh, certainly no particular hurry. Well, goodbye. Why, where are you going? After the school report. And he did. I stayed down there an hour, and surprised the workmen when they hauled up, and found a man on the rope instead of a bucket of rock. I walked home, 2-5 miles uphill. We had no school report next morning, but the union had. An ideal French address, extract from Aris Notes, an homme sawyer abroad, etc. I am told that a French sermon is like a French speech. It never names an historical event, but only the date of it. If you are not up in dates, you get left. A French speech is something like this. Comrades, citizens, brothers, noble parts of the only sublime and perfect nation, let us not forget that the 21st January cast off our chains, that the 10th August relieved us of the shameful presence of foreign spies, that the 5th September was its own justification before heaven and humanity, that the 18th Brumaire contained the seeds of its own punishment, that the 14th July was the mighty voice of liberty proclaiming the resurrection, the new day, and inviting the oppressed peoples of the earth to look upon the divine face of France and live, and let us here record our everlasting curse against the man of the 2d December, and declare in thundertones, the native tones of France, that but for him there had been no 17th Mardi in history, no 12th October, nor 9th January, no 22d April, no 16th November, no 30th September, no 2d July, no 14th February, no 29th June, no 15th August, no 31st May, that but for him, France, the pure, the grand, the peerless, had had a serene and vacant almanac today. I have heard of one French sermon which closed in this odd yet eloquent way. My hearers, we have sad cause to remember the man of the 13th January. The results of the vast crime of the 13th January have been in just proportion to the magnitude of the act itself. But for it there had been number 30th November sorrowful spectacle. The grisly deed of the 16th June had not been done but for it, nor had the man of the 16th June known existence. To it alone the 3d September was due, also the fatal 12th October. Shall we, then, be grateful for the 13th January, with its freight of death for you and me, and all that breathe? Yes, my friends. For it gave us also that which had never come but for it, and it alone the blessed 25th December. It may be well enough to explain. The man of the 13th January is Adam. The crime of that date was the eating of the apple. The sorrowful spectacle of the 30th November was the expulsion from Eden. The grisly deed of the 16th June was the murder of Abel. The act of the 3d September was the beginning of the journey to the land of Nod. The 12th day of October, the last mountaintops disappeared under the flood. When you go to church in France, you want to take your almanac with you annotated. Statistics, extract from the history of the Savage Club, during that period of gloom, when domestic bereavement had forced Mr. Clemens and his dear ones to secure the privacy they craved until their wounds should heal, his address was known to only a very few of his closest friends. One old friend in New York, after vain efforts to get his address, wrote him a letter addressed as follows, Mark Twain, God knows where, try London. The letter found him, and Mr. Clemens replied to the letter expressing himself surprised and complimented that the person who was credited with knowing his whereabouts should take so much interest in him, adding : had the letter been addressed to the care of the other party, apostrophe I would naturally have expected to receive it without delay. His correspondent tried again, and addressed the second letter. Mark Twain, the devil knows where, try London. This found him also no less promptly. On June 9, 1899, he consented to visit the Savage Club, London, on condition that there was to be no publicity, and no speech was to be expected from him. The toastmaster, in proposing the health of their guest, said that as a Scotchman, and therefore as a born expert, he thought Mark Twain had little or no claim to the title of humorist. Mr. Clemens had tried to be funny but had failed, and his true role in life was statistics. That he was a master of statistics, and loved them for their own sake, and it would be the easiest task he ever undertook, if he would try to count all the real jokes he had ever made. While the toastmaster was speaking, the members saw Mr. Clemens' eyes begin to sparkle, and his cheeks to flush. He jumped up, and made a characteristic speech. Perhaps I am not a humorist, but I am a first-class fool, a simpleton. For up to this moment I have believed Chairman McAllister to be a decent person whom I could allow to mix up with my friends and relatives. The exhibition he has just made of himself reveals him to be a scoundrel, and a knave of the deepest dye. I have been cruelly deceived, and it serves me right for trusting a Scotchman. Yes, I do understand figures, and I can count. I have counted the words in McAllister's drivel. I certainly cannot call it a speech, and there were exactly 3,439. I also carefully counted the lies. There were exactly 3,439. Therefore, I leave McAllister to his fate. I was sorry to have my name mentioned as one of the great authors, because they have a sad habit of dying off. Chaucer is dead, Spencer is dead, so is Milton, so is Shakespeare, and I am not feeling very well myself. Galveston Orphan Bazaar, address at a fair held at the Waldorf Astoria, New York, in October, 1900. An aide of the orphans at Galveston, I expected that the governor of Texas would occupy this place first, and would speak to you, and in the course of his remarks would drop a text for me to talk from. But with the proverbial obstinacy that is proverbial with governors, they go back on their duties, and he has not come here, and has not furnished me with a text, and I am here without a text. I have no text except what you furnish me with your handsome faces, but I won't continue that, for I could go on forever about attractive faces, beautiful dresses, and other things. But after all, compliments should be in order in a place like this. I have been in New York 2 or 3 days, and have been in a condition of strict diligence night and day, the object of this diligence being to regulate the moral and political situation on this planet, put it on a sound basis, and when you are regulating the conditions of a planet it requires a great deal of talk in a great many kinds of ways, and when you have talked a lot the emptier you get, and get also in a position of corking. When I am situated like that, with nothing to say, I feel as though I were a sort of fraud. I seem to be playing a part, and please consider I am playing a part for want of something better, and this is not unfamiliar to me. I have often done this before. When I was here about 8 years ago, I was coming up in a car of the elevated road. Very few people were in that car, and on one end of it there was no one, except on the opposite seat, where sat a man about 50 years old, with a most winning face and an elegant eye, a beautiful eye, and I took him from his dress to be a master mechanic, a man who had a vocation. He had with him a very fine little child of about 4 or 5 years. I was watching the affection which existed between those two. I judged he was the grandfather, perhaps. It was really a pretty child, and I was admiring her, and as soon as he saw I was admiring her, he began to notice me. I could see his admiration of me in his eye, and I did what everybody else would do, admired the child 4 times as much, knowing I would get 4 times as much of his admiration. Things went on very pleasantly. I was making my way into his heart. By and by, when he almost reached the station, where he was to get off, he got up, crossed over, and he said, "Colin, now I am going to say something to you which I hope you will regard as a compliment. And then he went on to say, colon, I have never seen Mark Twain, but I have seen a portrait of him, and any friend of mine will tell you that, when I have once seen a portrait of a man, I place it in my eye, and store it away in my memory, and I can tell you now that he look enough like Mark Twain to be his brother. Now, he said, I hope you take this as a compliment. Yes, you are a very good imitation. But when I come to look closer, you are probably not that man. I said, colon, I will be frank with you. In my desire to look like that excellent character I have dressed for the character, I have been playing a part. He said, colon, that is all right, that is all right. You look very well on the outside, but when it comes to the inside you are not in it with the original, so, when I come to a place like this with nothing valuable to say, I always play a part. But I will say, before I sit down, that, when it comes to saying anything here, I will express myself in this way. I am heartily in sympathy with you in your efforts to help those who were sufferers in this calamity, and in your desire to heap those who were rendered homeless, and in saying this, I wish to impress on you the fact that I am not playing a part. San Francisco earthquake, after the address at the Robert Fulton Fund meeting, June 19, 1906, Mr. Clemens talked to the assembled reporters about the San Francisco earthquake. I haven't been there since 1868, and that great city of San Francisco has grown up since my day. When I was there, he had 118,000 people, and of this number 18,000 were Chinese. I was a reporter on the Virginia City Enterprise in Nevada in 1862, and stayed there, I think, about 2 years, when I went to San Francisco, and got a job as a reporter on the call. I was there 3 or 4 years. I remember one day I was walking down 3rd Street in San Francisco. It was a sleepy, dull Sunday afternoon, and no one was stirring. Suddenly, as I looked up the street about 300 yards, the whole side of a house fell out. The street was full of bricks and mortar. At the same time, I was knocked against the side of a house, and stood there stunned for a moment. I thought it was an earthquake. Nobody else had heard anything about it, and no one said earthquake to me afterward, but I saw it and I wrote it. Nobody else wrote it, and the house I saw go into the street was the only house in the city that felt it. I've always wondered if it wasn't a little performance gotten up for my especial entertainment by the nether regions. Charity and Actors, address at the Actors Fund Fair in the Metropolitan Opera House, New York, May 6, 1907, Mr. Clemens, in his white suit, formally declared the fair open. Mr. Daniel Froman, in introducing Mr. Clemens, said, he intends to make this a banner week in the history of the fund, which takes an interest in everyone on the stage, be he actor, singer, dancer, or workman. We have spent more than $40,000 during the past year. Charity covers a multitude of sins, but it also reveals a multitude of virtues. At the opening of the former fair we had the assistance of Edwin Booth and Joseph Jefferson. In their place we have today, that American institution and apostle of wide humanity, Mark Twain. As Mr. Froman has said, charity reveals a multitude of virtues. This is true, and it is to be proved here before the week is over. Mr. Froman has told you something of the object, and something of the character of the work. He told me he would do this, and he has kept his word. I had expected to hear of it through the newspapers. I wouldn't trust anything between Froman and the newspapers except when it's a case of charity. You should all remember that the actor has been your benefactor many and many a year. When you have been weary and downcast, he has lifted your heart out of gloom and given you a fresh impulse. You are all under obligation to him. This is your opportunity to be his benefactor, to help provide for him in his old age, and when he suffers from infirmities. At this fair no one is to be persecuted to buy. If you offer a $20 bill in payment for a purchase of $1, you will receive $19 in change. There is to be no robbery here. There is to be no creed here, no religion except charity. We want to raise $250, $0,000, and that is a great task to attempt. The president has set the fair in motion by pressing the button in Washington. Now your good wishes are to be transmuted into cash. By virtue of the authority in me vested, I declare the fair open. I call the ball game. Let the transmuting begin. Russian Republic, the American Auxiliary Movement, to aid the cause of freedom in Russia was launched on the evening of April 11, 1906, at the Club A House, 3 Fifth Avenue, with Mr. Clemens and Maxim Gorky as the principal spokesman. Mr. Clemens made an introductory address, presenting Mr. Gorky. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.